We are coming up on the halfway point of the 8 o'clock hour. Welcome to a Wednesday edition of the Mornings with Ed show. Delighted to have you here on a beautiful day. Our guest this morning is a sculptor, a ceramist, a painter, a jazz musician. I wouldn't be shocked if he were a gourmet cook as well, man, I swear. His amazing imagination and skills are the reason our community has a universally loved 9/11 monument at Heisler and the Black Power symbol on the canyon. For years here in Laguna Beach, he's been the standard bearer for art that evokes conversations. Joining us for this conversation this morning is artist George Dubin. Welcome, George.
Hey, thanks, Ed.
How are you this morning?
I'm good.
Good.
A little early for me, but
now I was curious when we set this up, because when I first approached you about what we do and how early we do it, right. I got the double look. I got the stink eye from you, I think.
No, I mean I get up early. It just takes me a while to get revved up, you know. So.
Well, you seemed revved when you walked into the door. You walked in. You walked in as I was playing a Beatles song, so you seemed all right.
Man. All good.
Right on. Yeah. I've been really looking forward to this conversation because, as we say here on the program, it's no problem to have an uncomfortable conversation once in a while, and this subject might make some in town uncomfortable. We call ourselves an artist colony. Right? Yet you've had artist installations that have been rebuffed or removed for ruffling a few feathers. And just a few weeks ago, right here in town, right before Black History Month, artist Allison Allen had her exhibit removed from Wells Fargo. In fact, you were one of the ones that the television cameras spoke to when that happened.
Right.
Does a real art colony acquiesce to people that are frightened of art that speaks uncomfortable truths?
Well, you know, the community as a whole has changed considerably over the 47 years I've been here. So, you know, I was drawn here because this was at least for Orange County was kind of the hotbed of the art scene. And, you know, it also had a huge, evolving craft movement, which at the time I was, you know, fully engulfed in a ceramics career. So, you know, the art school had a ceramics program and, you know, it was the place to be. There was artists all over town. There was people, ceramicists had kilns in their backyard and wood shops and in garages. And it was great. So, you know, over the course of, you know, all these decades, you know, the things have evolved, you know, real estate prices have gotten extremely expensive and a lot of, full-time working artists just couldn't afford to be here anymore. And so they've left town. And you know it's disheartening, but it's been a thing that's been happening, and it's been a sort of a slow purge of the creative community for decades, and you know a lot of it is policy changes with down at City Hall in terms of you know regulating what you can do in your own home,
right?
And with real estate prices and so on, and so the community. Has changed, the demographics have changed. And, you know, it's for people to be offended by art, it's always just blows my mind because, you know, art for me is supposed to evoke dialogue and challenge people to, you know, to what they think the norms are and whether it's societal norms or environmental, political, whatever it is. And you know when that happened down at Wells Fargo, I was just like I was blown away. I just thought, you know, this is not the town I was drawn to.
Right. It's the epitome of everything wrong that should be associated with enjoying art. That's what art is supposed to do, is evoke those conversations.
Well, of course it is, and the thing is you know Laguna Beach, you know, it continues to present itself as an art colony, and you know it's been something that's been used. I'm afraid for you know to sell itself to the world, to you know to the realtor selling real estate. You know it's a cool place to live. It's beautiful. It's got this art you know consciousness, and over the course of especially in recent years, I think with the change of our political environment nationally and even some locally that. You know, this idea that a few people can control what's happening creatively is just it's something I can't even imagine, and it's something that I try to push to change people's minds. But I've, you know, the Allison's show being removed and then of course placed at the church was, you know, the church venue was actually a pretty interesting place for it.
It's a great place.
And you know, Wells Fargo, you know, I mean, if I had ever banked there, I would have certainly closed my account immediately.
They would have cheated you 2 years ago. They would have cheated your account. Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, censorship is a strange topic for me. And I, you know, I've been scrutinized and censored a number of times over the course of the last 40 years. And, right. You know, you kind of push back on it sometimes. And other times you just think, well, you know, this is not the town I have spent most of my adult life in. You know, it's changed a lot. And I think, you know, when it comes down to it, I've asked a lot of my artist friends, the ones that are left anyways, that, you know, how many full-time actual working artists who derive their entire income from their creative endeavors are there in Laguna Beach? And right. I was coming up with the number maybe 50, and a lot of my friends say, no, it's probably a lot less than that.
Right. As you walk through town, and the fact that you've been here 47 years is wonderful. So as you walk through town and you see pieces of art, works of art from locals, more so than 47 years ago or 25 years ago or 15 years ago even, are you seeing that there's more, and as you said, rent, the prices of homes skyrocketing, that there's more artists that are doing it out of hobby, the rich lady that can do it out of a hobby and she becomes an artist that hangs something in a gallery?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there is a lot of that. And, you know, I don't, you know, diminish anybody's desire to be creative and
or wealthy, and, by the way.
Yeah, well, the more power to them, I suppose, right. As long as nobody's bleeding over it, you know. It is a lot more of that, and I don't know how to really address it, because it's been a steady flow of creativity that's been leaving town. And I know a lot of the, you know, as you look around Laguna, we do have a pretty sizable public art collection. You know, I think it's over 80 pieces at this point, you know. And there's always a point to me where sometimes you can put too much frosting on the cake, you know. And to simply put a decorative thing on every street corner doesn't constitute an art colony, you know. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, I really wish that, we had less public art, but more major public art, you know, public art by people who aren't just, you know, either in the community or in the region, even that we were able to draw some international right. pieces by, you know, saving up the funds and, you know, spending $300,000 or $400,000 on a major piece of art that really would put us on the map. Because, you know, I mean, you know, we've got plenty of sea mammal sculptures and, you know, we live at the beach. We see whales go by. We see pods of dolphins. Right. We don't need to place more of those on every street corner around town.
Right, right. And is that's you think that's out of the realm of possibility with the Art Commission the way it's structured today?
The Arts Commission. I mean, if any of them are listening, you know, right now, I'm sure they're probably gasping a little bit. But I've butted heads with them on a number of occasions, and they have, there's some good people on it, but I think there's also some people who have been on it too long, you know. And I think what happens is that a personal aesthetic ends up becoming part of our public art collection here. And I think sometimes it's better to change that up. I mean, some of the greatest public art collections were curated by one person, not a group. And a lot of times when you get a group involved, the work tends to suffer.
Right. Okay. Would you ever consider being on an arts commission here?
You know, many years ago, I think it was back in the late 90s or right around 2000, I was asked to run for the arts commission.
Right.
Which I did, and at the time, you know, you had to go and be questioned by the city council at a public meeting,
right.
And I think there was 7 or 8 or 9 people trying to get on the Arts Commission at the time. For I think there was 3 positions open,
right.
And I not only didn't make the first 3, I didn't even make the alternate. And the funny thing is, one of the women that did get on, when asked a certain question about, you know, what would you do about XYZ, she said, well, I'm really not qualified to answer that question. And they put her on the Arts Commission. So that kind of, it says a lot about...
Take a seat, ma'am.
Yeah. It says a lot about, you know, the selection process. And, you know, if you're too outspoken or critical, you're not going to get on there. So, you know, I never looked back. You know, I thought, well, you know, if they don't want me on the Arts Commission, even though I'm more than qualified, I think, you know, it's not the place for me. You know, maybe I'm not that good working in a committee environment.
Or maybe you're exactly the type of person that needs to be on the Art Commission.
Well, I have friends who have applied who have been, you know, teachers, art teachers at the university level who didn't get on. And, you know, I've had conversations with city council members who have asked me what I think sometimes, and I've expressed my thoughts on that matter pretty bluntly, and they seem to keep reappointing the same people over and over again, and they leave some of the qualified people at the outside the door, and I don't understand why exactly, but I just think you know, there are some good people there, but you know, there's some people who certainly have done their service and need to move on.
Right. I want to talk about the Black Power symbol that you created. That is a magnificent work, and it seems so simple, but it evokes such emotion as I drive by it and I see it. I love it. Yeah. What's the story behind that? You created it and then they wouldn't place it?
Well, so the city was given a grant during the pandemic. I think it was around $100,000. Right. I think it was funded by a former council member. And they were giving out grants anywhere from, you know, several hundred dollars up to $8,000 to do some temporary public art pieces, especially in front of City Hall. And I had thought about it, and I thought, well, I don't know. I'm thinking about it. And I got a call from the chairman of the Arts Commission at the time, asked me if I'd heard about the program and whether or not I would apply, because he said, you know, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, something like, you know, we're not getting very many interesting submissions. And so I said, yeah, I'd been thinking about it. So I ended up submitting a concept, and it wasn't what you see in the canyon. It was a different piece. Okay. But it was about the times we were living in. It was a pretty aggressive piece, and something that I knew would cause controversy. But I felt, you know, if we're going to stand up for, you know, whether it's Black Lives Matter or, you know, just social justice or injustice, I should say, right. You know, we should be putting ourselves as a community, you know, standing up for our beliefs, you know, because a lot of people are running around talking about how horrible it is to see, you know, peaceful protesters being beaten and all this stuff. So the piece I designed, you know, spoke to that. And I got a call from the head of the Arts Commission about 3 or 4 days after they reviewed the submission and said, oh, you know, it's too much for the city. It's going to cause controversy. It's, you know, we're going to draw attention from news media and all this stuff. And it's just, we can't have that here, because they'll probably make us take it out the minute it goes in. So do you have anything else? And I said, well, let me see if I can, you know, reel it in a little bit, but I still want to speak to the idea of, it was mainly about, you know, racial inequality.
Right.
So I did a piece that I thought still spoke to that, but showed a more united approach, right, I should say. And that one was summarily rejected too. And I just thought, what am I doing? I was asked to do this, and now twice I've been rejected. And right, I thought, you know, screw that. I'm going to do a piece, and I'm going to, you know, put it out in front of where my studio is. And so I, you know, self-funded and fabricated the piece and put it out front. And that's the story, you know, and it's in a, you know, a place where most people are driving 45 miles an hour or faster, right, I should say. And so it, some people see it, you know, a lot of people don't see it, but, you know, that's okay. I just felt like, you know, I wanted to say something. I wanted to say it in a public way, and I didn't need to continue to be frustrated by the community I live in and the Arts Commission by rejecting pieces that are deemed, you know, somewhat controversial or potentially drawing too much focus to the city.
Right. It brings me to a scene in Amadeus where someone tells Mozart, your song is nice, but there's too many notes.
Yeah.
That's good. Too many notes.
Yeah,
though.
Exactly.
So you started as a ceramist. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. And you're back to it now.
Yeah. So I was fortunate when I moved to Southern California. It was in 1969. My folks were both college professors and got teaching positions at UCI when it was pretty new. And I ended up in Corona del Mar High School, which was a strange environment from where I had come from. And I'd just spent a year in London, so it was kind of a shock, you know.
Right.
And but fortunately, there was a really great ceramics department at the time. And the teacher, his name was George Corey, lived here in Laguna Beach and was in the Festival of Arts. And he was just a cool, interesting guy. And I got turned on to ceramics in high school and never really looked back. I mean, I became friends with George, and he was sort of my second father, you know, taught me how to get ocean fish and brew beer and all kinds of interesting things. But he was the one who kind of really kept me interested in going to high school. But after that, I was my full-time career for 20 years. And of course, seeing Laguna be a vibrant place for the resurgence of the craft movement. Right. I thought I gotta be down there because that's where it's going on. And I came down and was fortunate to study with a couple of ceramicists who were teaching at the art school at the time. They had a great facility there. So, and then plowed ahead. I was painting on the side a little bit, but my main focus was ceramics.
Right. Let me ask you the dumb guy on the street question right here. With a ceramic project or a painting or a sculpting, do you approach them differently as you're creating? I mean, do you think of them differently?
Well, you know, ceramics is, you know, obviously three-dimensional. And I've always had this, I've always been drawn to things that have sort of an organic quality to them, you know. And I know that if you looked at my paintings and you looked at some of my sculpture and you looked at my ceramics, you'd kind of wonder, this looks like three different artists' work. Right. But to me, I see a common thread in there because I approach everything sort of the same way and through the same sort of organic evolution. And so I don't differentiate between all those things. I feel lucky that I have a lot of different skill sets that I can, you know, I can jump around and do different things. Right. So for 20 years, my first 20 years in Laguna, I should say, that was my focus was ceramics in it, and it was evolving. And I was also I had a design business with a partner in the 80s, and I learned a bunch of other skills, you know, from working with metal and doing patination work and fabricating all kinds of interesting furniture and accessories and all kinds of stuff. So all that started to play into my creative output, and at the same time I was painting more and started with watercolors and realized that wasn't the thing for me, and tried acrylic and I didn't like that either because they dried too quick, and I finally just found oil paint and realized that was the medium as far as painting for me, and so I sort of evolved into being more of a painter, and I my ceramic studio kind of left the building, so to speak, and I didn't have one for about 20 years, and then I would say about 12 or 13 years ago I was able to put together a little space and got back into doing ceramics, and now it's become a part of my output. So
excellent. You mentioned the Festival of Arts earlier, and I'm curious. You were a part of the Festival of Arts as well as Sawdust.
Yeah.
Are they limiting? Is that a limiting thing to be an artist at a festival?
Well, the Sawdust, of course, you know, started in the late '60s as a kind of a free for all art format. You know, and there was no rules. It was basically you make what you make and go for it. And over the course of some time, you know, they started to regulate, you know, more and more and creating more and more rules and to govern what you could do or not do, or, you know, what kind of materials you could use. And I was in the Sawdust Festival in the late 70s through about 89, 90, somewhere around
there. I think that's where we got the picture that I showed you when you walked in.
Yeah. So, for 3 years in the early '80s, I was actually on the board of directors there, and I was the president for 1 year. And And I became pretty disillusioned with how the operation of the place was going forward with, you know, continuing to try to regulate creativity. And by the when I got off the board, I basically my exit speech was, we should throw the rule book out and go back to how it was when it started, because it was way more creative, way more vibrant. And you know, yeah, there's going to be artists that are, you know, do things that are probably inappropriate as far as buying stuff and reselling it. But most creative people don't want to do that. They want to make their own, you know, express themselves in their own way. So I kind of hung in there for a little while longer, and then I finally got booted out of the sawdust for some rule infraction.
Really?
Got kicked out for life.
Oh, for life? No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And right around the same time, sadly, or maybe fortunately for me, the same thing happened at the festival, because I had realized over there that I wasn't going to really ever make any money at it, you know, because the kind of work I was doing it's just not what people decorate their homes with. You'd have to be more of an art collector. Right. And so, my last year there was in 1989, and the last day of the show, I had the first annual memorial, Elvis Presley memorial barbecue down there. the powers that be at the time didn't take too kindly to it. About 6 months later, I got a letter from him saying I was summarily dismissed for life from the Festival of Arts. And just a quick backstory to that is, this year, as sort of a test to see, you know, if we are still living in an edgy art community, I applied for the Festival of Arts in the fall.
Oh, I love that.
And I didn't even make it past the first round. I was summarily rejected again. And I just thought, well, that's the times and the place I live in now. They don't want anything that's going to upset the apple cart.
There's like a wanted poster of you up in the Festival of Arts, and also at Sawdust. Yeah. Do not allow this man
if
in.
You see this guy, go the other direction. Yeah,
you're also a really good musician, by the way. Oh, don't think that we don't all stop by when you're, for instance, your band is out at Zinc or whatever, wherever you are, that we don't stop by and enjoy your music. Music your first love? Art your first love? Or what? How did that work?
Well, you know, when I was in high school, I was in high school bands, of course, and I was, you know, in the pantheon of all the musicians that were there, I was sort of the fourth choice for drummers, you know. So there were some really good players there, and including a gentleman named Mike Hamilton, who went on to play with Kenny Loggins.
So you went to high school in Oregon?
No, in Corona Del Mar.
Oh, Corona Del Mar. Okay, that was Corona Del Mar High. That's right. Okay.
Yeah, and Sue Thomas, who was became Michael Steele with the Bengals.
Okay.
So,
wow.
So I was, you know, I was around some good players, and so I always had these dreams of being a rock and roll star, you know. And of course, I realized that several years out of high school that my visual creative endeavors were going to be a little bit better than my musical skills. So. Right. But I played off and on, you know. I had times where I didn't play for 4 or 5 years. And then in the early 90s, I got together with some local guys here, and we all discovered had a love for traditional country western and western swing music. And we put together a band called Buck Naked and the Chap Cheeks. And we played, you know, around South Orange County, like the Swallows and the Crazy Horse and Cook's Corner and those kind of places. Right. For about 7 or 8 years, we were, you know, kind of got pretty good at what we were doing, and everybody had day jobs and came from different places, but you know, we were dedicated. We practiced a lot and had it together for a long time, and then I kind of faded out of that. And I'm sure a lot of people have lived here a long time remember Partners Bistro. Rick was a friend of mine who owned the restaurant, and he decided that he wanted to start having live music like 5 nights a week there. And so I asked a friend of mine, Gary Hogan, who a lot of you may know from around town forever. I said, you know, Rick wants you to do a jazz night or two there. And he said, well, if I'm gonna do the gig, then you're gonna be the drummer. And I went, Gary, I've never played jazz in my life. I have no clue how to do this. So, anyways, I started, you know, back into playing music relatively full time, and that was 20 years ago, I guess.
I'm not trying to blow smoke in your face, but you play jazz drums as if you've played them forever.
Oh, well, that's nice to see. Yeah, I mean, I'm super critical of my own of my own playing. And when I see people that I respect and who I think are amazing, I think, well, I'm still in grade school while they got a couple PhDs, you know, it's like, so, but anyways, it's been a nice, sideline thing for me. It's not a full-time thing. I really appreciate the local venues that have, like the Zinc, and we just recently played at Harley, and we've done some gigs at the newly renovated public spaces at the Hotel Laguna. So, you know, the town, you know, there are some venues for live music here, which is great, and I support them as much as I can.
Excellent. So I want to go back to the art for a second and kind of mix it in with what we're seeing and what we've been covering here for the last 12, 13 days in the Ukraine. As you see the images and what's unfolding there, are you storing information in your head to work on a piece of art?
Oh, yeah. It's, and one of the things I do as a little sideline thing for social media is I create like what I consider to look like sort of vintage revolutionary posters that comment on you know, events of the day or the year or whatever. And so I've already done a few of those as it relates to the Ukraine. You can see them on my Facebook page if you're interested.
Absolutely.
But as far as painting, yeah, I'm already, you know, sort of some ideas are circulating in my head. And, you know, I always believe that, you know, artists should comment about the times we live in. Right. And I think if you look historically at, you know, great social upheaval or revolutions that have happened, there's always writers and musicians and visual artists that are sort of at the forefront of creating the visual parts of what's going on. And I really believe that it's important for all creatives, regardless of field, to say something about what's happening in the world and say it in a, you know, however they see fit, and, you know, and try to evoke a response, you know, and attention to what's happening. So, yeah, there'll be something coming out of
it. Right. I can't wait. I am so looking forward to it, as I've been looking forward to this conversation, man, I swear. And then please come on back anytime. I enjoyed this half hour flew by.
Yeah.
Our guest this morning has been George Dubin. Anything you want to say before we go?
Well, I want to believe that there's a place for the younger generations of artists. Like, you know, I came to town when I was in my early 20s, and I hope that we can continue to create an environment that allows younger artists and creatives to be in town, afford to be in town, be supported by the community, whether it's through City Hall or just the people who live here. Because I'd hate to see us continue to move away from the core values of what Laguna was founded on.
I think the way to do that is for you and maybe another like-minded artist or two to jump on the Arts Commission.
I've got my hands full with being on the Planning Commission. So.
Okay. George Dubin, thank you so much for being here this morning. A delight to talk to you.
My pleasure, Ed, and thanks for having me.
Thank you. 8:56 the time.